Strange Days Indeed continues with Errol Bruce Knapp on UFO News Radio, CFRB 1010.
Program 214 of these Strange Days Indeed. We go down to New York. John Velez, the moderator of the Abduction Information Center email list, also the webmaster of the Abduction Information Center's website, joins us. John had an interesting day yesterday. He was at George Washington University, where a symposium was held, Interstellar Travel and Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, Science Fiction or Science Fact.
Good evening, Errol. Hiya, Bobby.
Hi, John.
How was it, John?
It was time well spent. I was very, very impressed with the quality and the caliber of the panel. I was a bit let down by the turnout, and especially the turnout of the media, which was minimal, to say the least. I believe there were two or three local media representatives, one from their Fox network. There was a representative there from the Washington Post, and I believe one other local station, and I think the only periodical that sent a representative was Wired magazine. In spite of the poor turnout and the poor representation of the media, the panel itself was deep and impressive. It was composed of several individuals that are very prominent in the academic world. Dr. Richard Henry, who's a professor of astrophysics at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Michio Kaku, who's a professor of theoretical physics at City College at the City University of New York. Dr. Bernard Haish, who we're all familiar with from his recent posting of a website calling for fellow academics and scientists to take an interest in the UFO phenomena.
A skeptic in the purest sense of the word, an astronomer, too.
In the pure and good sense of the word, yes. Mm. Dr. Bernard Haish is the director for the California Institute for Physics and Astrophysics.
Mm-hmm.
Also in attendance was Dr. Jacques Vallée. For the listeners who may have seen
Close Encounters
of the Third Kind, the French researcher in the movie, that character was based on Dr. Jacques Vallée, who is a real-life UFO researcher. He's also an astrophysicist and a computer scientist who's now working in the private sector in California in Silicon Valley. Ted Rowe, who's the executive director of the National Aviation Reporting Center for Anomalous Phenomena.
NARCAP.
NARCAP, yeah. Mm-hmm. Folks who are familiar, who have been following Strange Days Indeed for a while, will know the name Richard Haynes and Don Ledger, folks who have made and compiled an unbelievable database of reports from professional pilots, military pilots. Also there was John Callahan, who's the former division chief of accidents and investigations for the FAA. Now, this, you know, I don't want to blow past this guy because this is no lightweight. This is the guy who was in charge of all and any investigations involving accidents with airplanes, mid-air collisions, and I can't overemphasize how important John Callahan's testimony is and how much weight it carries. And in addition, Dr. Peter Sterik, who's a professor of applied physics at Stanford. Folks who follow ufology will recognize the name Peter Sterik from the panel that was named after him. The symposium yesterday lasted 4 hours. It started at 9 a.m. and it ran through till 1 p.m. in the afternoon. And it was chock full of information. I was deeply impressed with the courage that these gentlemen showed by committing themselves in this way in public.
Mm.
They're literally putting their careers and reputations on the line by making a public stand and a public call like this for scientists and academics to join them in conducting a scientific investigation into the UFO problem.
Most of these people have come out in the past, but nonetheless, it's good that they're there. These are people who have letters after their names.
Yeah, stand-up guys, as they
mm-hmm.
say.
You recorded a lot of what went on down there yesterday.
Yeah, I managed to capture a good 80% of the proceedings.
And you have some clips that we're going to hear. Do you want to set up the first one?
Yeah, sure. Actually, the first two clips you'll hear are John Callahan, who was for 6 years division chief of Accidents and Investigations branch of the FAA in Washington, D.C., John was involved in an incident in 1986 that involved a Japanese Airlines 747 commercial flight that was fully stocked with civilians that was followed by an unidentified flying object for 31 minutes over Alaska, actually just outside of Anchorage. There was visual confirmation, as well as air-based and ground-based radar confirmation. John presented videotaped radar evidence, air traffic voice communications, and paper reports. The clips that you'll hear, John is describing some things that are being shown on a screen. Before he did his presentation, he spent 5 minutes giving the people that were gathered there a crash course in Radar 101 so that we could understand the visual data that he was about to present to us. But I'll let John speak for himself.
At 0219, the thing starts. What you're looking at now is a guy who just bought a video camera. Back then, it cost $1,000 for this video camera, and it weighed 10,000 pounds. Sat it on my shoulder, and I thought I would just take a picture of what we're looking at. So you're just going to see for a few minutes, you see how that slash goes this way? And you see a little dot behind the slash that just disappeared? That target is not there. You did not see that. For you guys that said yes, shame on you. You did not see that. It was not there. And you'll see it again. In a moment, it pops up. You can't hear the voice right now. This flashing you see over here, that's the video camera red light that says it's being recorded. Some people thought that was a UFO. But again, this says Japan 16-28. When I get done focusing it, it says he's at 350, traveling at 500 knots. And the arrow pointing now says he's going in this direction. The line that goes this way says he's under the computer's control. That little dot that just showed up right there
is not there. He is not off the right of that 747. He does not exist, okay?
You can shut the video off if you want because this goes on for half an hour. But now let me tell you who else didn't see it. And I'm going to read you some of this, the summary that the FAA put together, their report that doesn't exist. The chart was put together from the printout of all the data we have that says what goes on that scope. I have all the printouts. I have the voice tapes. The radar controller said in a report that he wrote that he saw the UFO target. The handoff controller wrote that he also saw the target. The D-man, the data man that's helping him on the interphone, he said he saw the target. Everybody standing there saw the target. They all saw the same target you just saw. They saw the same target that the administrator saw. Okay? The military controller saw the target. The FAA has to kill the story. So the FAA says after we analyze all this data, it's our conclusion that it was a split beacon. The three pilots in the cockpit looked out the window and they said, if they had said it's a Learjet, everything would have been great. They would have followed that thing forever and tried to catch him. If he said it was a military jet, it would have been great. They would have followed him forever. He said, it's a spaceship. It's a UFO. Who believes in UFOs? So right away, we put a thing to it. When they looked out the window, they said, he's right there. They saw it on their radar. They saw it out the window. It's like looking at those three urns over there and me telling you that those three urns are not there. It's a split beacon. The pilots don't see split beacons. The pilots don't see ghost targets, okay? It says at 219, the pilot of JL-1628 requested traffic information from Anchorage Sector 15 controller. When the controller advised there was no traffic in the vicinity, JL-1628 responded that they had same direction traffic, approximately 1 mile in front, and appeared to be at their altitude. When queried about any identifiable markings, the pilot responded that they could only see white and yellow strobes. At 2:25, 1628 informed Anchorage that the traffic was now visible on their radar and the 11 o'clock position, 8 miles. At 2:26, Anchorage contacted the Military Regional Operations Control Center. And I'm being tapped. All right, well, I think you got the picture. The military guy seen it. The military said we have it on another one of our radar. It is twice the size of a normal primary return. It is a very big return. They all seen it. They seen it visually, and yet the CIA said the event never happened.
One of the things I didn't bring out is when we got done explaining to the CIA and the Reagan Scientific Group what had happened, and the CIA takes all the data. I asked him what he thought it was. I thought initially that it was probably the stealth bomber, because that was coming out about that time. And he said the same thing the admiral said, it's a UFO. Now, one of my functions in the FAA was whenever air traffic was involved in some type of incident, we had to send out a Twix to all the media that said everything was okay. The air traffic controllers are doing a good job compared to where they were a year or two ago, and what happened now, everything's fine. So I said to our friends from the other side, well, let's send out a Twix and tell the media that we were visited by a UFO. He says, no, we can't do that. Why? Because it would scare the American public.
Twix. Well, we civilians used to call them Tulexes. The voice of John Callahan, the former FAA Division Chief of Accidents and Investigations.
The next clip, you're going to hear two voices. The first voice is Ray Suarez, who's a senior correspondent with the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, a familiar name to a lot of people here in the States. And the second voice you'll hear is Dr. Jacques Vallée, a voice that very few people have had an opportunity to listen to.
Lately.
In my work, I'm constantly running up against government officials, and currently with the most secretive administration in modern times, that sees government-generated knowledge very much as its own property rather than the property of the public, constantly running up against people who will either dissemble or lie, or simply deny that something is a fact. And it must make your jobs quite difficult when you're trying to explain the so far unexplained, rule in or rule out plausible explanations for observed phenomena. What about that garbage in, garbage out problem, and how do you deal with it when trying to nail some of these questions down? Dr. Vallée, why don't you get us started?
Well, we've all, of course, been discussing, the possibility that the government, and I'll remind you, I'm originally from Europe, and the United States is only 4% of the landmass on Earth, and so this is a global phenomenon. So you have to assume that there would be a conspiracy among all governments to hide the facts of this. This is not just something that one government in Washington here can control. So we have to deal with a variety of hypotheses about who might be hiding these reports and why. And in my own investigations, I've met a number of witnesses who came from the military. And I work in Silicon Valley, and one time the CEO of the company I was working with told me he had a friend who was a naval officer who had seen UFOs and wanted to discuss the subject with me. So I had lunch with this naval officer. This was about 4 years ago. And he told me he had seen UFOs three times. The first time he was a kid in Texas, saw something in the sky. That didn't count. The second time he was flying a high-performance aircraft over the Southwest, had a co-pilot with him. They saw some lights under the aircraft. The lights were, at first they thought it was some burning bushes in a ranch or something, except they were moving with the aircraft. And when they turned, these seven lights kept going under the aircraft, kept going in a different direction. Third time he was flying from an aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean to an air show over England, was off the coast of France, bright afternoon, and he saw a disc that he described to me as a silver, very clear silver disc, much higher than he was. He estimated, perhaps 90,000 feet, and he said it crossed the sky like this. So I said, well, the $64 million question is, who debriefed you? And what questions did they ask him? And he looked me in the eye and he said, I wouldn't be the skipper today of a nuclear aircraft carrier in the United States Navy if I had reported this to anybody.
The voices of Jacques Vallée and Ray Suarez. But John, we're not quite as under the gun as we thought we might be for time. And sorry to rush you along on those last couple of clips. Was there anything that you wanted to say about Ray Suarez and Jacques Vallée?
Yes, but I'll do that when I set up this next clip, because it happens to be Ray Suarez, who was also the moderator for the panel discussion for the day. The clip that's upcoming is going to be just Ray Suarez. I just wanted to preface the clip with a personal comment that, I'm out here year after year after year trying to raise public awareness about abductions. It was gratifying for me yesterday to hear a journalist of the stature and clout of a Ray Suarez express the following very personal feelings and thoughts about the abduction phenomenon.
And Ray Suarez, senior correspondent for the NewsHour on PBS with
Jim Lehrer.
Yep. Okay, let's listen to Ray Suarez.
I want to know about why stories of 19th century fairy abductions are so similar to stories of 20th century alien abductions. I want to know why the fairies that people describe in these abductions look so similar to the people described in pen and ink drawings by people who say that they were kidnapped by aliens in the 20th century. Coming at it from one end of the continuum, you could say that it is an archetypical delusion, that really there is no separation between fairy abduction stories in the 17th and 18th century and alien abductions of today. It's just that somebody in the 18th century wouldn't have known that such a thing as a spaceship was possible, so they put it in their Middle European world of wood spirits and fairies and so on, and that the archetype of the delusion has that rounded head, the childlike gait, the slit eyes, and all of that. Do I know who's telling the truth? Absolutely not. Am I interested in knowing? Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting that this thing has been occurring not only just in the last 50 years during Cold War science panic, but happening for centuries all over the place. I hope that my business can ask better questions about those kinds of things and keep an more open mind about the answers and spend a little less time winking at the audience.
Yeah, nice line. Less time winking at the audience, huh?
Talking about the giggle factor.
Yeah, exactly. Interesting, his comment from the outset was, I want to know all of this stuff that's been going on all of this time.
He was very candid, Errol. Mm. It was a moment that you knew the man was expressing genuine feelings and curiosities and his own thoughts about what is essentially a very disturbing phenomena, series of reports.
And it's probably a good job that a lot of media wasn't there. The feed to the media was not the cleanest.
To apologize to the listeners, there were a few glitches in that.
And it sounds like it was coming out of the electronics in the room down there rather than from anywhere else.
I was plugged right into their board, Errol. I was getting a direct signal from their sound system.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to close with Dr. Michio Kaku. Again, I'd like to emphasize that Dr. Kaku is one of the most prominent theoretical physicists alive on the planet today. This guy is not just your average university professor. This is a very, very prominent individual in the scientific community and more specifically in the field of theoretical physics. I have been calling for a multidisciplinary investigation into this phenomena for many, many years. And I got to hear Dr. Michio Kaku echo those sentiments at the symposium yesterday.
But I think it's going to take pressure from below. I mean, let's face it, politicians, you know, will fight change with every fiber in their body until they realize that change is inevitable. Then they take credit for it. So I think we're going to have to put pressure from below. This means having conferences like this. This means having reputable scientists say that this is worthwhile. Because remember, the SETI project back in the 50s and 60s was considered crackpot. Now it is slowly entering the mainstream. So I think it is going to be an agonizing process, but I think it's going to take reputable scientists, reputable eyewitnesses to come out and press for a certain fraction of the NASA budget, let's say, to be given to the authoritative investigation of these phenomena.
You know what was impressive about that, Errol? That they weren't just offering up citing cases and talking about this colonel or general saw a silver disc. They were presenting basically a roadmap that we can follow that will lead to the greater involvement of the larger academic and scientific community. One of the proposals Dr. Kaku was making is that, again, on a grassroots level, he seems to feel, and he's telling us as a scientist what we have to do in order to make this a reality, is to make our voices heard, number one. As he said, it has to come from the ground up, or else Congress will not respond. And the other very practical offering that he made was that we might suggest that a measly 1% of the budget that they give to, say, an organization like NASA be used to investigate a phenomena which these very, very prominent individuals and scientists feel is worthy of further investigation. And that, to me, was a very profound statement and a very profound and historical event that all these individuals gathered together and with a single voice are asking their peers, their fellow scientists and academicians, to join them in investigating a phenomena which to date has been considered a pariah and like a plague by professionals. You have to remember that scientists live in a very tight-knit, closed, incestuous almost community, and that there's a lot of ridicule and derision, and your funding could get yanked, you could lose your position at the university if you affiliate or associate yourself with something that's considered fringe or flaky or not of the scientific ilk. And I thought that everybody on the panel was made up of some very courageous individuals that were willing to speak in public and make their feelings and thoughts on the subject known.
When you and I were talking, was it earlier today or last night, you said that Dr. Bernard Haish had said something really interesting, because one of the things that a lot of skeptics say is, well, you know, astronomers are always looking at the skies, and if they'd seen something, they would have told us about it.
Yeah, why don't we ever hear from astronomers?
Right.
Well, I don't remember the name, and I haven't been able to track it down on the tape. Maybe we can, in a future program, I'll have that clip. But Dr. Bernard Haish told an interesting story. He had attended a symposium of astronomers, and the subject came up of UFOs, and he happened to be talking to an astrophysicist who's the head of a major observatory, and I believe it's in Canada, who intimated to him that, yes, he had in fact seen a UFO, and to paraphrase his own words, he said that he knew for a fact that he had not observed an astronomical or natural phenomena. And now listen very carefully to this next comment. He said that he also knew that he was not looking at a man-made machine. So that, you know, this is an astronomer acknowledging the fact that, hey, I saw a UFO. I saw an unknown craft in my eyepiece, and that I know it was a mechanical device. Dr. Haish wrote him a letter after that symposium asking him if he would be willing to come forward and share his own experience publicly. And the astronomer never responded, which is indicative of the level of fear of expulsion from the scientific community, loss of credibility among their own peers.
And funding grants.
Yeah, yes. They worry for their careers and their livelihood, these guys. But according to Dr. Haish, he says a number of astronomers will privately admit to either having had sightings of their own or that they feel that there is enough data and evidence available now to justify further investigation, although they will not cross that line and be the first guy to say, I want to look into the subject.
Yeah, I wonder who the brave soul is going to be who does that.
And breaks the ice. Huh?
And starts a movement among scientists. Huh?
We already have a couple. We have Michio Kaku. We have Dr. Richard Henry, who's a professor of astrophysics at Johns Hopkins. And we also have Dr. Bernard Haish, who's a very prominent astronomer and director for the California Institute of Physics and Astrophysics. So those are some heavyweight guys right there.
Yeah, yeah. John, I want to bring Stephen Bassett in. He's lurking in the background there, listening to this down the phone line.
Earl, hi, and hi, John.
Hi, Stephen. Long time no see.
I want to thank John for coming all the way down to Washington to attend that news conference, get those clips, and provide them to you. That's the kind of work that keeps adding up and eventually going to take us to the result that we need.
And for those of you who are just tuning in, there was a symposium titled Interstellar Travel and Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, Science Fiction or Fact, which was held at George Washington University yesterday. And John Velez drove his body down there with his tape machine and picked up some clippage for this program, for which we're very grateful. Grateful to John and to the folks at Podesta Mattoon and specifically Ed Rothschild for setting up John to be there. John, are you okay, or would you like to head off and go to bed? You've had a long couple of days.
Yes, sir. It would be nice.
Good night, John, and thanks for those clips. Good work, man. We'll come back with Steve Bassett, Bobby Rowley.
Strange Days Indeed will continue with Errol Bruce now on UFO News Radio, CFRB 1010.